previously on Revolution Revisited.
Three Nicaraguan militiamen were killed by guerrilla mortar fire, and one man was wounded.
The Contras, directed by the CIA, are inflicting more casualties than ever before.
As long as there is breath in this body, I will speak and work, strive and struggle for the cause of the Nicaraguan freedom fighters.
The Contras have intensified their efforts.
But the Sandinistas have also stepped up their efforts.
Over the 1980s, the U.S. ramped up its involvement in the Contra Wars. Luis Carrion was a member of the Sandinistas' nine-man leadership group, known as the National Directorate. And as he puts it, the pressure on their government was relentless.
We had an economic embargo. We had direct sabotage actions by CIA operatives.
Meanwhile, Sandinistas were being aided in this fight by Cuba and the USSR. But there was also a third factor at play here. The U.S. may have started the violence, and the USSR may have helped keep it going, but the Sandinistas were making plenty of messes all on their own.
We always felt as if we were fighting for our life. We acted as such as anybody who feels to be in mortal danger would act excessively, you know, responded with excesses.
On this episode of Revolution Revisited, how those excesses ultimately became the Sandinistas' undoing. Three stories of how the FSLN alienated the very people they were hoping to lead. To some, FSLN arrogance and excesses tarnished the sheen of a young revolution. To others, the FSLN turned into a brutal dictatorship of its own. Gioconda Belli, who we heard from in the first episode, was drawn to the Sandinistas for reasons beyond Marxist revolution.
I was very aware of this revolution having to do with a revolution that would change things for women. Because I was also in the Sandinista program, was the equality for women. It was very early on, it was put on the Sandinista program.
Women organized throughout the 70s to extend the revolution to women's rights. Sandinista women formed their own organization affiliated with the front. It was called the Association of Women Confronting National Problems. They advocated for broad social reform.
We wanted to have legal abortion. We wanted to have equal pay. And women, for example, in the countryside could not have the titles. The land titles were given to the husbands. Legislation that would attack the problems against women, like rape, you know, like domestic violence, education for women, all those kinds of things. We all felt taken into account. We felt that we were participating. Of course, you know, there is a very big distance between what men talk about and what really happens.
After fighting alongside men in the revolution, in the 1980s, many women were pushed towards adopting more traditional roles in the FSLN.
As the Contra War came to be, we were more and more put in the position of mothers, the mothers of heroes and martyrs. They were telling us that we could not have our reivindications yet, that we had to wait because the revolution had more important things to think about than to, you know, start working on women's demands.
Increasingly threatened by this war, the front's goals narrowed and narrowed.
We had to defend the revolution and raise production. And that was supposed to be the two objectives that we had to struggle for, and everything else was secondary.
Only a few women rose up the ranks of the FSLN. Gioconda was one of those few women. The Nicaraguan feminist group within the FSLN became less and less radical in its agenda. For a moment, Gioconda and others split from the group and organized a new group with a different approach.
Called the Party of the Erotic Left. That was a clandestine party.
That didn't last long. While progress had been made, by the mid-80s, it was clear that a revolution for women in Nicaragua was on hold. And in other parts of society, the revolution was actually more like a giant step backwards. The next two parts of this episode look at a dynamic that played out over and over in the 1980s under the Sandinistas, and they explain a lot about how the FSLN lost so much support in Nicaragua during the Contra Wars, and actually drove some folks into the arms of the Contra. To start, you have these young men leading a country. Many are well-educated, and they think they know how to run Nicaragua better than anyone else. So when they inevitably make mistakes, they weren't really that open to criticism. They were arrogant, and confrontations followed. The Sandinistas didn't just ignore opposition. They set out to destroy it. Which brings us to part two, book smarts versus farm smarts. During much of the Contra Wars, Alejandro Bendaña served as Nicaragua's vice foreign minister. He was one of the chief spokespeople for the Sandinistas, especially in the U.S.
U.S. News and World Report did a study on people who have most appeared on Nightline. I was like, top five, like, ridiculous.
But Alejandro found that defending the FSLN became more and more difficult as the Contra Wars raged on. One thing that stuck out to him, and to many Sandinistas, was the troubling way they managed Nicaragua's economy, particularly how they altered the lives of Nicaragua's farmers. As Alejandro puts it,
the Nicaraguan Revolution made the same mistake that almost every social revolution in the 20th century has made, which was exactly to antagonize the small landholder.
The Sandinistas came into power with big plans for transforming Nicaragua's economy. It was a central part of their Marxist revolution. In college, Luis Carrion and Alejandro Bendaña read Marx, studied the history of the USSR and Cuba. Most FSLN leadership was smart, thoughtful, passionate, and dedicated. But there was one thing they lacked.
None of the Sandinistas had ever really had a job. None of them had a peasant background. None of them knew what life was like in the countryside.
They knew lots about the, quote, proletariat. What they didn't know much about were actual Nicaraguan farmers.
Anybody who spent time among those people realizes peasants are actually very conservative. They want to have a small plot of land of their own. And they can be brought along, but not forcibly. These are people that have a strong sense of their own identity, and they're very conservative in many ways. So the Sandinistas were caught up in ideological fantasies and had no personal experience that would allow them to realize that they were fantasies.
At the beginning of the revolution, the Sandinistas promised what they called a, quote, mixed economy. It was supposed to be some combination of a Marxist planned economy, like existed in Cuba, but also with private enterprise and private property. Some folks described it to me as something closer to a present-day social democracy. But once they came into power, that mixed economy became less mixed. The state took over huge parts of industry. They turned farms into co-ops, they managed supply chains, they set prices. And with all that, they made lots and lots of new rules.
I talked to a person once after spending a day in a little rural country store about why there were no eggs.
Stephen Kinzer reported on these land reforms in the mid-80s.
She said, well, I have a bunch of chickens and I sell eggs, but I have to sell them for a fixed price. And when I have to bring them to another town, I have to get a car and I got to pay for gas.
But when she goes to this new town, she's not allowed to raise the prices of eggs to account for the cost of gas.
Therefore, I can't bring eggs to this town. That's why there's no eggs here.
Kinzer says things like this were happening all over the country under the Sandinistas. With cattle ranchers, for example.
You were no longer allowed to kill your cow whenever you wanted and sell the meat. You had to sell your cow to a government agency at a fixed price. The government agency would then slaughter the cow and then would sell that meat at a nice low price to all the poor people. But this never worked, of course.
Ranchers earned so little money from their cattle that they couldn't survive on what they made. Many slaughtered their cattle at night and sold beef illegally. Others found new markets.
As a result of all these policies, large herds of cattle were smuggled across the borders to Costa Rica and Honduras. There became less and less meat. That was just one example.
Many commodities were now controlled by the state. Many farms were now owned by the state. To lots of rural Nicaraguans, this revolution started to look more like theft. And those who resisted weren't taken too kindly.
In an effort to control dissent, political repression followed these harsh economic measures. That combination started to push ordinary peasants into the arms of the Contras. And at the period of the mid-1980s, it was clear that the Contra movement was expanding beyond its original base of a bunch of old Somoza officers and really did include a lot of peasants who had been alienated by Sandinista policies.
As Mateo Harkin puts it,
It's rural peasants that fill up the ranks of this massive army.
We see something similar in what was maybe the darkest chapter of the Sandinista rule, their treatment of Nicaragua's indigenous groups. Nicaragua's national politics, from Sandino to Somoza to the FSLN, was always based in Managua and cities on the western side of the country. Nicaragua's indigenous groups mostly lived on the east side of the country, along the Caribbean Sea.
That coast is a totally different world from Spanish-speaking Nicaragua. And they speak English and Creole, and originally colonized by the British, not by the Spanish. And they're separated by a vast rainforest, which even today is not crossable. There's no real road from one side of Nicaragua to the other.
Miskitos were mostly left out of Nicaragua's political life. And in many ways, that's exactly what they wanted.
During the Somoza regime, they were largely left alone. They didn't bother anyone and nobody really bothered them. They were allowed to develop their own lifestyle, which was pretty remote, very tied to the land.
I'm a Miskito Indian from the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua.
This is Armstrong Wiggins. Armstrong grew up in a small village on the East Coast where classes went up to the second grade. He got a scholarship to go to school in Puerto Cabezas, a town about 30 miles north of his hometown. He and his mom had to travel there by canoe.
So my mom and I used to paddle, get to the place and walk 45 minutes alone. And my mom will go back to the village and I would stay 1 week. And on Friday, she will come and pick me up.
Armstrong went to the U.S. for college, a rare thing for someone in his town. When he came back, he became more and more involved in politics and advocating for indigenous groups in Nicaragua. And that's exactly what he was doing when the Sandinistas came to power in 1979.
The Pacific people,
that is, people from the West Coast, like the Sandinistas,
didn't understand us because they thought we were backward, stupid.
The Sandinistas came into power with complete ignorance of Indian traditions. To them, the Miskito Indians were primitive, and they tried to go out and incorporate them into these schemes of cooperative farming, and there were food restrictions as the war intensified.
The FSLN started sending teachers into Miskito communities, bringing with them a culture and values the Miskito felt like weren't theirs.
They wanted to teach us in Spanish, and our elders didn't speak Spanish. We wanted to do it in our own language, our own political views. And so Sandinista realized that for them to promote Marxism and Leninism in a state like Nicaragua, they had to destroy the Miskito thinking.
In September of 1980, in the eastern city of Bluefields, Miskito parents staged a protest against these FSLN teachers.
And that's where the civil war started between the Miskitos and the Sandinistas.
they uprooted thousands and thousands of Miskito Indians from their ancestral homelands and shipped them to a barren place inland and made them live there.
Miskito land was taken over by the FSLN.
Meanwhile, they would chop down the trees and level the land in ways that was tremendously damaging and spiritually horrifying to many Miskitos.
Sandinista soldiers burned some villages to the ground and executed some of the more vocal dissenters. Many Miskitos, like many farmers and peasants around Nicaragua, fought back. For some, that meant joining the Contra. Others felt that neither side could be trusted and tried to resist on their own. Armstrong was in that second group, and people like him were caught in an impossible position. To either side of this civil war, they looked like the enemy.
If you're not with the Contras, you are a communist. If you're not with the Sandinistas, then you are CIA. That was the game that they gave it to us, to me, and to all of us.
Over the course of the 1980s, what had started as a U.S.-led insurrection grew into a chaotic, deadly civil war. Atrocities were committed on both sides, but as Luis Carrion saw it, there was no other option.
The most important thing was to stay in power, because power was the indispensable instrument to bring about all the changes and the social transformation that we wanted. And there was too much of that.
By the late 80s, the Contra and the Sandinistas were at a complete stalemate.
The Sandinista government had succeeded with Cuban advice and with Soviet funding and weapons. They had succeeded in preventing the Contra from taking any territory from which it could have declared a provisional government, but they couldn't annihilate the Contra, right? So the Contra was still standing. The Sandinista government, against all odds, really, was still standing. And at the same time, the U.S. found it more difficult to continue its intervention because of the Iran-Contra scandal.
The Iran-Contra scandal. Let's pause on this for a minute. So starting in the early 80s, the U.S. Congress limited U.S. funding of the Contra. The Reagan administration and the CIA, however, were not happy with this.
As long as there is breath in this body, I will speak and work, strive and struggle for the cause of the Nicaraguan freedom fighters.
So they decided to go around Congress and basically secretly fund the Contra. And in the process, they broke all sorts of laws. First, they sold arms to the Iranian government, breaking the U.S.'s embargo with Iran. That's a whole different podcast. Then they took the profits from those sales of weapons and funneled that to the Contra. This arrangement, it got out in 1986.
I didn't know about any diversion of funds to the Contras, but as president, I cannot escape responsibility.
There were hearings and indictments. It was a huge mess. But for our purposes, the key takeaway is this. By the late 80s, the U.S. truly, finally ends all funding to the Contra. This might have been a boon for the Sandinistas had their benefactors not been under pressure as well. We're talking the late 80s now. So the USSR is right on the verge of total collapse. And they pulled their funding from the Sandinistas.
There was no way to go on with the war. The Contra had lost the U.S. support. We had lost the Soviet Union support. There had been a bloodshed, a carnage. Thousands and thousands of people were killed, maimed, orphaned, displaced. It was an untenable situation.
Pressured by neighboring countries to find a peaceful end to the war, in 1988, the Sandinista and Contra leaders start holding negotiations in the Nicaraguan town of Sapua on the border with Costa Rica. After several days, the press is invited to an event in the town. Stephen Kinzer, and practically every other reporter in the country, drives there. They arrive to an empty stage. The event is delayed.
At midnight, they came out and they would put 8 chairs out, 4 on each side. We were, okay, everything's covered. Then somebody came out and they took 2 chairs away. Oh, what does this mean? Long 15 minutes of discussion among the reporters. We don't know. Then they take away the chair for the moderator. Oh, no moderator. This means it's good. No, it's bad.
Finally, Contra and FSLN leaders come out together, and they sign a formal ceasefire agreement.
It was 2:30 in the morning. Very last chance for me to make the last edition of the New York Times. And there's no way to contact anyone except for about 4 pay phones to service about 100 reporters who were there. And so I ran over. I was managed through a series of moderately corrupt maneuvers to get one of those 4 pay phones. And then I had to dictate my story as the announcement was being made. So I'm explaining in my story what is in the contents of the peace agreement as the peace agreement is being read from the stage. So I'm pausing in my dictation to listen to the next sentence and then trying to summarize it.
What Kinzer was scrambling to relay to his editors in New York was the end of the Contra Wars.
He said, this is probably going to be the biggest story you're ever going to have in the newspaper. Let's go over it word by word. Nobody knew what it was going to lead to, but we knew what it ended. Everybody there was weighed down with the horror, the tragedy of everything we had lived through. That means the Sandinistas, it means the Contras, but it also means those of us in the press corps. I mean, all of us had seen more blood and more crying mothers and more dead bodies than anybody should have to see in a lifetime. And for us, the idea that this now might be ending was also a tremendous relief, as it was for the political people who were actually involved.
The Sandinista government and the opposition agreed to hold free, monitored elections. If it could be done, it would be a model to the world. And the Sandinistas had a new challenge: how to transition from a militant vanguard to a plain old political party. Perhaps the more pressing question was, who's going to run against them?
People in Nicaragua start saying to my mother, look, you are someone who can unite all of us.
That's Cristiana Chamorro. Her mother, Violeta Chamorro, was a former member of the Junta for National Reconstruction and widow of national martyr Pedro Joaquin Chamorro.
She had no enemies. Everybody had admired her late husband, and she was able to pose as a great unifying figure.
And finally, there was a group who came to propose her to become candidate. I asked her, are you sure you want to go? And she said, look, if Nicaragua needs me, I go.
She campaigned always dressed all in white, as if she was a kind of a mother of Nicaraguans.
It would be Nicaragua's first free elections in their country's history. On one side was Daniel Ortega, leader of the Sandinistas. On the other side was Violeta Chamorro. The FSLN allowed for close external monitoring of these elections. They loosened their grip on the country's institutions and on their opposition.
They genuinely, they start like lifting press censorship. They start negotiating with opposition actors. They allow the Contra to come back into the legal sphere. This is the most important thing. They let there be just total international monitoring. You know, there were more foreigners than Nicaraguans for that election. I'm joking, obviously, but it was you know, thousands of monitors, right? So they could not have rigged the election even if they wanted to.
As Alejandro puts it,
we organized the first totally free election in Nicaraguan history. I never felt prouder. Of course we thought we were going to win.
Sandinistas prepared for victory.
Election day happens, right? Daniel Ortega calls George H.W. Bush to invite him to the inauguration.
At 7 o'clock, the observers and the Electoral Supreme Council and all of them called us. They said, congratulations. You are government.
Sandinistas lost. People started coming to the Chamorro's house to celebrate. And early the next morning, Ortega formally conceded.
Ortega accepted, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, he came out with a speech and accepting his failure. And later that day, during the afternoon,
Jimmy Carter was in Nicaragua monitoring the elections.
Jimmy Carter invited Ortega to come to my mother's house to accept the results.
Ortega came over. As Cristiana remembers, he was a little nervous. No one really knew what to do. The Sandinista leaders, and Nicaragua in general, weren't used to elections. But Violeta was eager to move on.
My mother came out to Ortega and say, don't worry my son. You know, here we are all family, don't worry.
Not long ago, few Nicaraguans could have imagined this moment. Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega handing over his title as president to 60-year-old Violeta Chamorro.
Violeta Chamorro was sworn in as the new president of Nicaragua, ending 10 years of rule by the Sandinistas and a decade of mutual hostility between Nicaragua and the United States.
Respetar la Constitución, las leyes y los derechos del pueblo, y si no, os haga responsable. Muchas gracias.
And then I went home, demoralized, depressed. But in the next few days, I came to see what had happened as a great opportunity for Nicaragua to maybe build a democracy. Which we fail. In the end, we fail.
Next time, on our last episode of Revolution Revisited, how Nicaragua endured a dictator, a revolution, a civil war, and finally free elections, only to see a new dictator in power today. Revolution Revisited is brought to you by the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Our show's produced by me, Dan Richards, with production assistance from Alina Coleman. Our editor is Julia DeWitt. John Mazza's our executive producer. Music by the Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Alex LaFerriere, Sarah Baldwin, Catherine Dunkelman, Steve Bloomfield, Stephen Kinzer, Mateo Harkin, and everyone who spoke with us for this show. For more information about the conference this podcast is based on, including photos, lectures, and a short film featuring many of the voices you heard on this podcast, visit watson.brown.edu/Nicaragua. We'll be back next week with our fourth and final episode of Revolution Revisited. Thanks.